is Robert Brothers v. Turner. Mr. Jerkowitz.
Good morning, judges. May it please the court. What is the role of the means test for purposes of confirmation of a Chapter 13 plan?
Jurisdiction first.
Thought we might go there. This is an appeal, a direct appeal.
What's your answer?
This court has jurisdiction to determine this, Your Honor.
No, you started with a question. What role, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
What is the role?
The means test is a tool to be used by courts to determine the actual projected disposable income at the time of confirmation of a plan.
So why should a judge disregard, really solid evidence that he has at the time when he has to make his ruling?
Is Your Honor referring to the means test as a solid evidence?
When the judge issues his bankruptcy decree, he has to determine, how much disposable income the bankrupt has. And why shouldn't he base that ruling on whatever, good information he has, even if it's different from the information that was contained in the bankruptcy filing?
I totally agree with that analysis, Your Honor. The means test is just one tool at the judge's disposal to determine projected disposable income at the time of confirmation. He's also got the debtor's Schedule I, which is a schedule of income.
Oh, I'm sorry. I reversed the parties in my mind.
I like the way you were headed, Judge.
Okay.
Can I go back to jurisdiction a minute?
Yes, Your Honor.
If we don't have jurisdiction, we don't get to the means test. We don't get these various tests. And I'd like to hear a little more on your jurisdiction issue, because it seems like there's two issues going on. One is there was not literal compliance with the procedure. There may have been substantive compliance with it. And there's some other little nuances that take place, too. But I think we need have to get through jurisdiction before we can get to anything else. I may be wrong on that. But
you're right. We'd have an academic discussion of something that may not be material to the decision if there's no jurisdiction.
Right.
Fortunately, we do have jurisdiction here. 28 U.S.C. Section 158 is a new statute for purposes of the Bankruptcy Code in 2005, which provides for a direct appeal from the bankruptcy court to the courts of appeal. There's a number of steps that must be met in order to perfect that appeal. First, the debtor files a petition with the bankruptcy court seeking that its order be certified to the district court. Thereafter, the debtor has an opportunity to object to that petition. The bankruptcy court then certifies the issue and, in this case, transmitted its certification together with the trustee's petition and a short record to this court. All of that took place within 10 days of the bankruptcy court entering its certification on its docket.
But there was one step missing. You never filed a request for certification in the Court of Appeals. Am I correct on that?
That's correct, Your Honor. No specific petition was filed as set forth in 28 U.S.C.
You're saying the transmittal was the equivalent of the petition. Did it contain the information the petition would have contained?
It did, Your Honor. It's the functional equivalent of what the petition would have contained. And, in fact, the petition would have been redundant information. Perhaps it would have been in a more condensed format for the court to review when this court determines that it will authorize the direct appeal. But all the information that should have been contained in the petition was on this court's docket and in a timely manner.
But it was a transmittal that was carried out by the district court.
Bankruptcy court, Your Honor.
The bankruptcy court, excuse me. But not by you, not the petitioner.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
so you weren't actually asking us to accept the case and making an argument in favor of that, which is generally what a petition for an interlocutory appeal requires. It was just a record transmittal, as I understand it, right?
It was a full record transmittal, in that the record contained more information than a simple notice of appeal. In this case, 28 U.S.C. 158 doesn't require that the petitioner file the petition. It just says a petition shall be filed.
So what's the distinction? A petition shall be filed.
It worked out in this case.
Petitioner shall file a petition.
In this case, the petition, the information or functional equivalent was transmitted to this court, regardless if it came from my hand or from the bankruptcy court's hand. Unfortunately,
well, that's a very loose interpretation of a jurisdictional rule, it seems to me.
I would like to remind the court that we were all operating under a new statutory right for direct appeal.
Doesn't matter.
And we were feeling our way through the system.
We get new rules all the time. We still require compliance with them.
And I agree, Your Honor.
And the rules about, I mean, these basically incorporate a pre-existing interlocutory appeal procedure, right?
That's
the
correct.
The Rule 5 procedure?
That's correct.
Which has been in existence for a while, right?
That's correct.
And requires the party seeking leave of the Court of Appeals to bring an interlocutory appeal to file a petition and explain why and present to the court the relevant lower court documents, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And
Rule
none
5
of that happened in this case.
Rule 5, in fact, requires the petitioner to file the petition rather than saying that a petition shall be filed. But I like to refer to Rule 2 for an excuse as to why the petitioner didn't, in this case, file a petition, and yet the functional equivalent of the petition was before this court in a timely manner.
Well, actually, no petition was before this court in a timely manner.
No separate petition. Correct.
The district court documents were before this court, but no petition. That's the problem.
Contained in the bankruptcy court documents was the trustee's petition to the bankruptcy court.
To the bankruptcy court, not any petition to us.
Correct. But that petition met all the same elements that would be in the Rule 5 petition that would be required by this court.
Didn't ask us to do anything.
Correct, Your Honor. And yet the Wise Motions panel did authorize this appeal to go forward.
Well, isn't one thing kind of jumped this a little bit was the fact the clerk docketed up here before there had been a ruling on whether, on which you'd never filed, the certificate of appealability. The sequence would be that you would file a certificate of appealability, there would be a determination on that, then it would be docketed. Is that the way it would normally go?
Correct, Your Honor. The bankruptcy court would docket its order authorizing the appeal. At that point, in an ideal world, the petitioner would file his petition with this court within 10 days of that hitting the bankruptcy docket.
Right. What happened here, it got docketed here before that had happened.
What happened here was the bankruptcy court entered its order granting petition and then transmitted the functional equivalent to this court within 10 days.
I think what you're saying is that the important part of the rule is the timely, is the 10 days.
Correct, Your Honor.
So what you filed, what was transmitted to the court, although it wasn't labeled as a petition, was timely and was understood by the other side as you're invoking our jurisdiction.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But it didn't permit a response in opposition.
At the bankruptcy court level, it did. At the district court level, I'm sure that the debtor received the same notice that we did of the docketing at this court.
Right, but what would ordinarily happen is that if a petition for leave to take an interlocutory appeal is filed with us, the opponent would have an opportunity to file a response under Rule 5 within 7 days, and we would consider that before entertaining the petition. And all of that was overlooked here, it seems to me, because no petition was actually filed. This just snuck in under the radar without anybody ever noticing the problem.
Well, has the other side argued that had there been a petition, they would have filed a response saying we shouldn't take the case?
I've not asked them that because
trivial or something or settled or what? I don't know. Have they said that? Did they say that in their filing on jurisdiction? Did they say, if we'd known, we'd have convinced the court they should never take this case?
No, Your Honor.
Said that.
The other side argues that we don't have jurisdiction because of the way they interpret what was transmitted to this court. But they do not say they would have objected had they received a petition.
I mean, it's obviously a review-worthy issue. It's an important case.
Yes, Your Honor.
We've got amicus briefs.
So, do you have a co-counsel arguing?
Yes, Your Honor. The United States trustee is also going to appear as amicus here.
Is there something you'd like to say on the merits before you turn it over to him?
I've read his brief, and I trust that he'll cover the merits adequately, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Urquhart. So, Mr. Setko?
Thank you.
Are you the...
May it please the Court, I'm Matt Setko on behalf of the United States. This appeal should be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. In Bowles, in two...
We discussed that, unless you have some novel point to make that Mr. Urquhart didn't make.
Only that in 2007, the Supreme Court said, when a condition is required by statute, which this is, then it is illegitimate, which is the Court's word, to create equitable exceptions. So the statute in this case required that a petition shall be filed within 10 days. That condition was not met within 10 days.
So wait. So you're arguing against jurisdiction?
Yes, we have asked for dismissal.
I thought you were arguing on the merits also.
Our brief, Your Honor, asks for dismissal. Or in the alternative, reversal.
Yeah, but I don't know why I should listen to you arguing against it, because we have an opponent to argue against jurisdiction.
But the United States...
So it's going to be 2-1?
Well, under the appellate rules, the United States is entitled to act as amicus. It's not unusual for the United States to raise jurisdictional issues.
Why do you want to fuss about the jurisdictional issue?
Because
why
we
do you care?
Because well, for two reasons. One is because we're an agent of the Court and we feel we have an obligation. Second, a petition is not a mere document, Your Honor, as this Court recognizes. It's a process, as Judge Sykes has noted.
I don't understand what that means.
Then I will explain what I'm trying to say, Your Honor. What I am trying to say is the petition is a three-part process. First, a petition is filed with this Court, which is what the statute requires.
Okay, let's not go through the three parts again. Now, they didn't file a petition. Instead, but within the 10 days, everything what would be in the petition was transmitted to the Court, except a request that we exercise our discretion to accept the appeal. But as Judge Sykes said, everyone agrees it's a case worthy of our review. So what is the loss of information or what have you from not having had the petition?
There's no loss either way, Your Honor.
Okay, so why are we fussing about this?
Because it's a mandatory jurisdictional issue.
Well, that assumes the answer, right?
I can share the United States.
If they had the petition on the wrong colored paper or something like that, or if they misspelled petition, what if they said an application for review? Would say, oh well, you'd say, oh, that's not a petition. Is that what you'd say?
It depends on according
well,
to the
answer
Supreme
my question. Suppose it's captioned application for permission to appeal.
If it's statutory
no.
and if it's jurisdictional.
Would you answer my question?
Yes, Your Honor.
If they had submitted a document which said application for permission to review, would you say that it failed to invoke our jurisdiction because it wasn't a petition?
Yes, because it was required by statute.
That's ridiculous.
The Supreme Court said it is...
The Supreme Court has never said that jurisdiction can't be invoked by a document which uses the wrong words.
That's not what happened here, though, Your Honor.
Yeah, but your position is extreme, because your position is even if they mislabel it, if it contains everything that a petition for appeal would contain, but it's mislabeled, it still doesn't invoke jurisdiction. That's a kind of medieval argument.
Were it required expressly by statute, as the petition was expressly required by statute here, and it's in Title 28, then it would be jurisdictional. To the extent it's not in Title 28, if it's a rule, then certainly this Court has equitable discretion over its rules. This Court lacks when it's jurisdictional.
But the question is not whether it's a rule or a statute, but whether this irregular motion of proceeding, because it was timely and because there's no issue of whether this is review-worthy, is a sufficiently serious error to warrant dismissal?
Well, then, yes, Your Honor. In that case, I would briefly turn to the merits. And this is an important and recurring issue. It's also before you. You've accepted certification in a second case, which is 091212. It's been briefed or argued or decided by five United States Courts of Appeals. And your first question in the government's view is the important one. The construction suggested by the debtor works for no one. On pages 16 and 17 of the green brief, we show how the Ninth Circuit Kagan-Viyama approach has resulted in inequitable results in the Ninth Circuit. A dead spouse's income was required to be computed in calculating that debtor's ability to repay. A debtor who had a one-time sale of cattle was required to include that. Someone who was abandoning two houses and a car for $7,000 a month was allowed to take that phantom expense. And on the merits, we think that the forward-looking text of the statute and the inequitable results for debtors, because in two of the three Ninth Circuit cases and in Lanning, which is the Tenth Circuit case, which has been decided the victim was the debtor. They were being victimized by being asked to pay income they could not pay. Here it's the debtor attempting not to pay creditors with income that the debtor has.
Is it your position that the mechanical approach specified in the statute is the starting point and there's a presumption in favor of it, and that the broader forward-looking projection approach can be used to overcome that presumption? Is that the proper interpretation?
Yes. Mechanically, the statute works this way. You do calculations for disposable income. Then, as you noted, the statute then requires you to project that, which is a forward-looking word. And what the Eighth and Tenth Circuits have done, and most lower courts have done, is they say you look at the evidence about the specific expense items that were calculated. And if, as a matter of mere evidence, there's substantial proof that over the five-year payment of this plan, because these Chapter 13 plans will go over 5 years, if there's likely to be a change as a matter of fact, and a trial court would find that as a trial court would find any other fact subject to appellate review, then the number would change. And so we think it's prosaic, really. And in the majority of jurisdictions where it's being applied that way, to the government's knowledge, there's been no trouble. And it has not produced these inequitable results for debtors, and it has not produced these inequitable results for creditors.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Serpico.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Haller?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jim Haller. I'm the attorney for the debtor, the appellee in this case. If the Court doesn't mind, I'd like to address jurisdiction right off the bat.
Well, we've heard a lot about jurisdiction. Do you have a fresh point, or are you going to repeat what Mr. Setko said?
I'm not going to repeat. I have a fresh point, Your Honor.
Okay.
The problem with the functional equivalent rule, two problems. Number one, it denies my client due process. As Judge Sykes stated...
Well, wait a second. Well, what do you mean? You didn't have an opportunity to argue we shouldn't take the case?
That's correct.
Well, you can argue it now.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that this is the case that the court should be taking, because we're dealing with a very specific section of Section 707B, and what the trustee is doing is using that as a springboard to raise all sorts of issues with respect to income, which weren't even part of the lower court's decision. I think the frequency that this happens in above-median income cases, in my perspective, and I'm just a old debtor's attorney, and I meet with lots of clients, does not happen very often. So I don't believe that this is a case that's really with this particular factual issue that we have.
It's going to be happening a lot a lot more often because of the economic situation. A lot of people, their mortgages are underwater, and they abandon the house, abandon it. There are a lot of abandonments to the mortgagee, because if you have a house worth considerably less than your mortgage, you may decide, well, this is a bad investment. I'm just going to give up the house. I'll just give it to the give it to the mortgagee. So we'll see a lot of these probably.
I think in my experience, Your Honor, and you're probably absolutely right. In my experience, people who want to surrender their house generally will go into a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. That's my experience. They usually will not file a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. Generally, 13s are where people want to keep their house, and if they're in a foreclosure, it forces the creditors to allow them time to get caught up on their mortgage payments. So a surrender of a mortgage as a deduction in Chapter 13, in my experience, is not common.
Well, except, you know, the administration pressed, apparently unsuccessfully, for Congress to allow cram-down of mortgages on primary residences in Chapter 13, thinking that somehow that would be an attractive route for people.
That's correct. That would have been interesting if it had passed. I wasn't looking forward to all the work that I was going to have to do.
Did you object to the certificate of appealability in the bankruptcy court?
We did not. We did not object to that. The problem that I see, and the other issue that I want to raise on jurisdiction, is if the functional equivalent rule is applied and allowed by this court, the issue is how are future appellees supposed to determine what is a petition for permission to appeal? If basically in this case the bankruptcy court submits 30 or 40 pages of documents and several days later submits 100 pages of documents, is it the duty of the appellee to sift through those documents and figure out if a petition for permission has been filed? Certainly there will be enough information to meet Rule 5. It would certainly lay out the issues if it contains the judge's opinion, but it doesn't put my client on notice. And I think it's a very dangerous holding, frankly, in my perspective, because at that point, what do I respond to? And frankly, if I file a response, what does the court look at? If I file a response and say, well, based on the 150...
I mean, there's no question if you're prejudiced that, of course, that then we wouldn't hear the merits. But I don't... And as I say, you've always been, it's always been possible for you to argue that that we shouldn't review the case.
I just wish I had a chance to review it 8 months ago, Your Honor, and I might not have spent the amount of hours I had preparing for the merits before this court this morning.
Oh, that's a fair point. So what about the merits? You want to say anything about the merits?
Absolutely. I want to talk about tools.
You want to talk about what?
Tools.
Tools?
Tools. Appellant started out by stating that Congress gave bankruptcy judges lots of tools to determine what a debtor's projected disposable income is going to be. And that was the case prior to the 2005 amendments. And frankly, that worked great. The best person to make the decision is no doubt the judge, who can sit there and look at somebody in the eye and say, you're telling me the truth, or that expense isn't worth it. There's absolutely no doubt that that is correct. But the 2005 amendments basically said, we don't think the judges are doing their jobs correctly, particularly with those with above median income. So Congress is going to, we're going to substitute our judgment for what we think is fair for the judge in certain specific circumstances. For example, with respect to income, prior to the 2005 amendments, judges uniformly allowed Social Security income and required it to be used as part of the ability to test, the ability to pay test. Courts never allowed a 401k deduction.
Are you pointing to some amendment that bears on this case?
Well, the amendment that bears on this case, Your Honor, is Section 1325b3, which specifically states that for an above-median income debtor, the reasonable expenses shall be those that are allowed in Section 707B. And the issue is, frankly, is whether or not those expenses in 707B are a congressional determination of, frankly, what's reasonable. Or if once we determine what those expenses are in 707B, if the bankruptcy court then has jurisdiction.
I don't understand you. This mortgage expense, he doesn't have this expense. What's the reasonableness business?
Well, the issue of
expense when he filed for bankruptcy, but when the bankruptcy judge had to make his decree, the expense had disappeared. So Where does reasonableness come in?
With respect, Your Honor, and I say this with utmost respect, it's not the court's venue to determine reasonableness.
It's you who said, well, I don't understand you. It's you who said, you know, Congress wanted to get away from bankruptcy judges making reasonableness determinations. Fine. But how does reasonableness enters into simply an observation that a person's debt has been extinguished?
Oh, I think if we look at it from a reasonable perspective, it
makes absolutely no sense. What does reasonableness have to do with any? I don't understand you. It's not a discretionary, it's not a subjective judgment. It's saying there was a debt, it's vanished. Where is the bankruptcy judge exercising discretion, looking people in the eyes, or anything of that sort?
Because Section 707B specifically allows that deduction. It doesn't say if you're going to pay
it. It doesn't say whether it allows it after it's disappeared.
Well, it hasn't disappeared. Once a bankruptcy is filed, that obligation still exists. The contractual.
Yes, but the question is, if the obligation disappears before the decree is made, is the bankruptcy judge required to ignore that change in circumstances? And it's not a matter of, you know, discretion or anything like that. It's, does he make his measurement of disposable income as of the time of the filing or the time of the hearing?
With respect to Section 707B, he makes it as of
the
time of filing.
Well, it doesn't say that anywhere.
With respect, Your Honor, I believe it does.
Where does it say that?
Section 707B 2-3 states specifically that the total of all amounts scheduled as contractually due in each month of the 60 months following the date of the petition.
Wait, I think I'm not looking at that. I'm looking at the right thing. Say that again. This is the section you rely on. What is it?
That's correct. It's section. There's all. I just love this new code because there's all sorts of subsections. Section 707B2A, and then little Roman numeral 3,
Romanets.
Then big Roman numeral 1.
Those are called Romanets.
Romanets. I apologize.
707B what?
B 2. Romanet 3.
There's an A in between there.
A, pardon me, 3, and then large Roman numeral I, which basically states.
And
I may read
I?
It for
you. Wait. 2I, 3I, what?
Yeah.
3I. The total of all amounts, is that it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Yeah.
And that says following the date of the petition. And, for example, Your Honor, I understand your question. Why don't we look at the expenses as of the date of confirmation? Well, the problem with that is if we use it, for example, in another context that the court used in the Rastuzzi case, the court in that case examined the applicable expenses in Section 707B, Romanet 2, which states specifically that the debtor gets the allowed expenses as in effect as of the date of the order for relief, which is the date of filing for the debtor, the dependents of the debtor. If we adopt the forward-looking approach, then what do we look at? We look at basically what the...
Wait, I'm still trying to figure out. It just says the sum of all amounts scheduled is contractually due to secured creditors in each month of the 60-month. Well, how does that bear on when you determine what is contractually due?
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
You think that the relevant date for determining what is contractually due is the date of filing, and your opponent argues it's the date of the bankruptcy hearing. So I don't see how this 2I distinguishes between these two dates.
Well, and frankly, Your Honor, the secured debt is secured as of the date the case is filed.
What are you talking about? How does this language distinguish between a debt as of the date of the filing and as of the date of the hearing?
Congress has stated.
Where in this language, which you think is critical, is there anything about the date of the date on which the debt exists or doesn't exist?
have two answers for you, Your Honor. The first answer is the last line, which says following the date of the petition, which indicates that we determine the contractual amounts as of the date the case is filed.
No, that's the beginning of the 60-month period.
Well, the date of the petition is actually the date the case is filed, Your Honor.
The date of the petition, look, this is telling you where you start the 60-month clock running.
Correct.
Run it from the date of the petition. It doesn't say when the debt has to be contractual, when the contractual obligation exists, whether at the date of the petition or the date of the hearing. It doesn't say anything about that.
I would disagree with you, Your Honor, respectfully.
Where does it say anything
about that? It says scheduled as contractually due to secured creditors.
Yes, contractually due when? On the date of the petition or on the date of the hearing?
It says following the date of the petition.
No. The following the date of the petition is 60 months following the date of the petition. That's not the contractual due date.
Well, my second answer, which may illuminate this for you, Your Honor, is Section 1325b3, where Congress says specifically that these expenses, whatever they are, Section 707, those are the allowable expenses to deduct for an above median income debtor.
Precisely. The question is, though, are they expenses as of the date of the petition or the date of the hearing? Which it doesn't say.
What we have to use is the date of...
It doesn't say anything about that. You've got to have an argument beyond the language of the statute because this issue is not addressed in the statute.
Well, if we look at it from a Chapter 7 perspective, Your Honor, clearly
We're talking about Chapter 13. Why are we looking at it from Chapter 7 perspective?
Because this is the test in the Chapter 7. This is the means test in the Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And in the Chapter 7, we would clearly look at it as of the date of filing. And if what the opposing counsel has argued is that the 707B test is different in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy than it is in a Chapter 13 bankruptcy.
Well, it is different because in Chapter 13, you have to make a determination of disposable income because that's the basis on which, you know, the bankrupt will be required to make installment payments for several years.
Well, I'd respectfully disagree, Your Honor. 707B can't be different in a 7 versus a 13. The means test in a Chapter 7 was designed to...
But the question is, do you make the means test at the time of filing or at the time of the hearing?
I think you have to take it as
How
written.
How about a reason why we should do it at the time of the filing, in case we don't agree with your intricate statutory...
I think it's because Congress wanted this to be a mechanical test.
It's perfectly mechanical. Look, you've got two dates. You can do the date of the filing, the date of the hearing. Either one is equally mechanical. It's just looking at two different balance sheets, balance sheet on date A and the balance sheet on date B. What's more mechanical about
using
a filing date?
I believe what Congress intended.
Why? Just tell me. Why is that more mechanical than using the hearing date?
Because it's more predictable, Your Honor, at the very beginning.
Why is it more predictable? Because when the bankruptcy judge makes a decree, that's going to be perfectly predictable. I mean, what's the problem?
The problem is when a client comes into my office and asks me what his plan payment is going to be, I have to be able to, in my office, indicate and calculate what that payment is going to be. The forward-looking approach would I'd have to guess. I'd have to say, after your bankruptcy is filed, I'm not sure what expenses in Section 707B are going to be applicable or not, because I don't know when your case is going to be confirmed.
Life easy for the lawyer.
Absolutely not. This is to make it efficient.
No, it doesn't make it easier for the judge.
I believe it would, Your Honor, because the facts are there in the schedules.
What?
The facts are there in the schedules, and it would be easy for the court to apply those facts to the test.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So is there any rebuttal time for anybody? No. Okay, well, then the case will be taken under advisement. And the court will...